My name's Jamie M, and I am an alcoholic.
Hi,
everybody. In a little town called Simi Valley, California, the Ronald Reagan Library there and the the Rodney King trial was held there because it was right on the other side of the Los Angeles County line. My dad and my parents are about 15 years apart. My dad had already lived a life. He was, 36 when he had me and scooped up my little bitty mom, and they smoked a lot of marijuana and probably drank a bit, and out I came. there it was. Goodness. Well, start off by saying that I am one of the 25%, meaning that as a young girl I was molested. And then my family didn't do anything about it. And that was my parents' marijuana dealer, so they weren't going to get rid of him. So then I lived next door to him for 14 years without any kind of closure. So if you don't think that might have turned a few screws loose, I think that did. My parents, there was a lot of anger, there was a lot of chaos, there was a lot of fighting, there was a lot of screaming. I remember my dad throwing my mom down in the closet, holding her down, trying to get her to stop freaking out. So I witnessed that. My mom said when I was 5, I came up and tried to hit my dad with a baseball bat because I thought he was hurting my mom. So there's some trauma also. Just anger and fear, and some different women, they process that abuse as a child. I became the good girl. I don't want to get in trouble. I don't want to go to the principal's office. I don't want to have anybody look at me. I'm just going to be the good kid. Of course, that changed years later, but at that time, I wanted to be the good girl. Definitely knew how to manipulate as a kid. I'd tell my mom one thing and tell my dad something else, try to get the toy that I wanted out of the store, and didn't have a lot of friends. Literally had like one good friend from third grade till 12th grade. And I really do believe that I had this illness that we all in here have, and that's that I was scared and I was alone. I didn't want to be with the kids my own age. I was raised up around a lot of guys because my dad would mentor. But I always liked to be with the adults or with the bigger kids. I didn't like to connect with people my own age and felt very intimidated and scared and alone, and was raised in the church, Christian church. I was baptized. Just never honestly felt it. Didn't really connect to it. I think there were times when I did, but it did not ring home true to my heart. I'll tell a funny story. When I was baptized, the pastor took his hand away from my mouth and it was covered in snot, and then he told everybody in the audience. I was like, thanks a lot, buddy. So not only was I already like nervous and scared and shy, and I really thought everybody else's parents fought like-minded. I really thought everybody else, was angry and hateful. So I'd hang out with my other friends' parents and I enjoyed them. Junior high, I remember being in youth group and there was a girl that I knew she didn't like me. I knew it. And I didn't like her either, So in my head, I'm playing those games that I know what other people are thinking. So again, there's more evidence that I was already sick before I ever picked up any kind of chemical. So I would try to cover up the sensitive, shy, insecure girl by being wild and rowdy and, banging into things and running into windows and just being an idiot. And that kind of covered up all the shame and the fear, we talk about in step 2 about, the last sane moments and the happy memories before things really got bad. And I used to ride my horse, and that was my thing. I had a quarter Morgan named Flip, and he was named after Flip Wilson, the comedian. And A was my buddy, and he was crazy like me and stubborn and hard-headed like me. And I could separate, it wasn't any kind of group. Never wanted to be in Girl Scouts, never wanted to go to those group activities. I wanted to play in the backyard with my dogs and, in the mud. But then when I had my horse, I could go ride and I could, be away from everything and everybody, and I didn't have to fit into a group, didn't like that. And I started going to a dance bar before I was even ever 21, and before I really ever started drinking, but used to two-step and swing dance, and that was a lot of fun. So those are some happier memories of when I was pulling out of it. Just to kind of finish up on the cap off the molestation, I was not yet sober, but I had asked, I told my parents that, and I actually did, through help with a counselor, I went and made a police report. And then the police, the sheriff called me up personally on my cell phone and said, I'm sorry, but we can't do anything for you. And the statute of limitations is never supposed to run out on child molestation. But in my case, there was a, it was called the McMartin case, and they, there were lawyers that would go and tell the children, well, he did this to you, didn't he? And you say this and this and this. And so everything from this time span was thrown out. So, of course, my mine was in there, which was about 81. Nope. Yeah, 81. And so I remember standing there at one of my rental properties, whatever I was living, and hearing the sheriff tell me, yeah, there's nothing we can do. So my dad and I were outside of his house, and the neighbor happened to come out, and I said, Dad, come on, I want to go confront him. And I walked up to him, and I said, how many of the little girls did you hurt? And he just fell. I like that word, crestfallen. He just knew. And he said, no, I'm so sorry. He's like, I was just a teenager, and I was just a mess, and I'm really sorry. And I hugged that man, and I said in his ear, I said, I forgive you, and I let you go. It's okay. I don't want to hate you anymore. And I just felt him hug me. Now, there was no sobriety. There was no recovery there, but I wanted to find a way to close that, and I'm very grateful that I did. Alrighty. Well, I've heard other speakers say that if they'd known they'd be standing and talking in front of a group of Alcoholics Anonymous, that you wouldn't have picked up that joint, but I didn't know that. So I did. That was my first exposure. I mean, we all had our dad's beers when we were kids, right? But I smoked marijuana with my my boyfriend's mom. Yeah, thank you for that. And then, you know, if the first time you get stoned, you really don't, or you smoke, you really don't get stoned because you have to build up a tolerance, so didn't really feel it. But honestly, for the next 19 years, it was a haze. And I was a binge drinker. I would drink for maybe about 3 days straight, and I'd wake up the next day, and my body would go, I'm going to have some more of that, you know, because you don't feel good. And I would honestly be able to go, no, give me some water, give me some food, I can't do this. So I actually, but the marijuana and later the benzos was all the time every day. But I don't know, like my mom's wedding, we were riding in the limo and there was champagne and I was, you know, hey, yeah, let's go, you know, free booze. That's the answer, right? Free booze. Then they tried, you know, to stop me, and then my mom's matron of honor actually went up and asked the bartender to pour me light. Like, that's a really good idea. So, and I honestly remember opening up the back door to the bar, grabbing whatever bottle I could find and flipping it up, and then laying out on her wedding on the boat out in the harbor, laying out and like passing out on the deck. So that was nice. But I will be able to make personal amends to my mom when I see her in a few weeks. So I'm excited about that. So let's see. Yes. Oh, I was also one of those drinkers that would throw up so I could drink more, you know, or I'd drink and drink and drink, and then I know I'd be going to bed, so I'd throw everything up so that I would wake up the next day and I wouldn't feel horrible. But I wasn't going to stop or try to, you know, there was no control in it. Gosh. And, you know, there's the endless barrage of who did this and who did what and with who and everywhere and anybody, and there was no, you know, moral depravity. There was no law. There was no rule. It was just whatever. And it didn't matter what I did or who I did. It was just to escape. One more thing to look forward to. One show, one date, one more anything. Just give me something else because I don't like how I feel. And let's see. Definitely blackouts, which I truly believe that people that aren't alcoholic, they really don't black out. They drink too much and they go to sleep. But we drink and drink and then we just keep running. I had a good friend of mine that was trying to join up with us, and she mentioned about blacking out, and I said, babe, I said, most people don't do that. You know, we get to that point where we cross that invisible line, and it's on, and it's cooking, and there's no stopping. And it's like we're on autopilot. And I remember people would say, well, you did this, and you said this. I did not say that. What are you talking about? That's horrible. I wouldn't say that. Guess what I did? I did. Or, you know, I'd come to the next day and like, yeah, you hit that person. Shit. All right. Well, backtrack. Remember being 19 and, you know, first drinking. And so this is early on in drinking career, right? There was a little kid that was messing with the cats. So I went up and I punched this little, probably a 12, 13-year-old kid. And I remember sitting on the lawn later, and his dad comes up and is yelling at me, and I coerced him into slapping me because I knew that's what he wanted to do. So I was like, come on, come on. And he did. And I just remember, like, you know, ouch. But it was fighting anger, violence, nastiness from the get-go. You know, this wasn't I'm going to drink and relax and chill out. It was, you know, let's turn on the tiger. So let's see. My first suicide attempt was when my daughter was pretty much a toddler. Of course, I was smoking marijuana every day and breastfeeding her, and that was what I did. I didn't get stoned or get drunk, at least past the first 8 weeks of my pregnancy, but it was on after that. Let's see. Yeah, you know, I was going to say, too, that, you know, so many people want to talk about marijuana not being such a bad thing, and it's just something to calm your nerves, and it treats depression and all this. But I can honestly say that I can feel the long-term effects of it. It honestly took me like a year or so of being sober for all that bong resin to clear out, and I still feel like I have a brain of Swiss cheese. Chuck will say things, and I'm like, say things that I said or say things that he told me. I mean, it's like crickets. What? I did that? I said that? I honestly think that there's brain cells that are killed and there's memories that are wiped out. There's memories of when my daughter was little. There's memories from childhood. I don't have them. And maybe some of those I blocked out, I'm pretty sure I did. But there's stuff that's not there. Is it all the marijuana? I don't know. But we've all, you know, done a lot of damage to ourselves, right? So let's see. Oh, let's talk about my dad. First time that I ever connected with my father was when we were stoned. And I helped him to understand that I'm not my mom and I'm not your mom. I'm me. Because, you know, Daddy had a lot of mama issues. And Dad was not necessarily my dad. He was my druggie buddy. He lives down in, I think, Bedford County now. And as sick as he was, I truly believe he's a candidate for our cause. But he didn't like me drinking. But I remember when he and I would drink together, you know, it was on and going. You know, he was like me, didn't drink every day, but it was on and going. Oh boy. So that was I was talking about my first suicide attempt, and I had no concept that I had a problem. I thought it was just depression, or, you know, I'd taken somebody else's antidepressants, and that got me messed up. And then, well, I'll get to that in a second. Moved to Tennessee on December 28th of 06. And I really think that things got worse. I did find again, you know, the drugs and the mess and the you know, the seedy people. But I was also isolating a lot more and living in a big 3,000 square foot house, you know, to myself. And it was like the gates were open. Any weirdos were coming and hanging out, you know, and exposing that to my daughter, to those things. I went back to visit my family in December 4 years ago, excuse me. And at this time that I told the doctors that I need a whole lot of Klonopin so I can sleep because I'm working back-to-back shifts, like 56 hours in a weekend. So I'm going to need some Klonopin so I can sleep. So I was in my grandparents' house in El Segundo and just was drunk from all day, probably boxed wine because ew, but it was there. Oh, God. So then I remember, I don't even know what it was. It was, you know, whenever you do these half-ass attempted suicides, a lot of it is just attention, and I'm going to just hurt me, you know, ouch, watch this. And so I just downed a bunch of pills, woke a couple days later with a respirator, and I'm tied down, and I'm going, yeah, this sucks. Okay. And, you know, they weren't treating me like a human. They were treating me like a psych patient. And, of course, at that time, no concept. Went to a trauma center for psych, you know. And I remember we took these clay, we'd knot up this clay and we'd throw it at this wall and get this anger out. And I was angry at everybody. And bless this one girl, I don't even remember her name, but she said, you weren't even mad at you. You didn't even look at you. And I was like, whatever, you know. I remember being in counseling the first time and the people in the group were like, well, you know, you're just hurting yourself. And I freaking ran out of there. What the fuck do you know? How do you know what I'm doing? I don't hate myself. What's wrong with you? You know? There again, evidence. Evidence of the way it was. Goodness. So like I said, when I moved to Tennessee, things got worse. My daughter's dad, another candidate, because we're surrounded by these people, aren't we? he would say, I can't even tell you how many times he'd say, just commit suicide. We're sick of it. We'll all be better off without you. Just go. Just get out. And it would just make me angry, you know. I would just like, you know, whatever, you don't understand me. You know, I got a rough life, and I'm depressed, and I'm kind of bipolar, and, you know, by that time I was on medications for bipolar and stuff. But my mom said, you know, you took those medicines, and you didn't get better. You didn't get better. And I didn't realize, too, that my family was beginning to back up and give up on me. My mom never did give up, though. She kept hanging on, and bless her, she's... good lady. We're going out. Sophie and I are going out to see her in about 3 weeks. I'm excited. Okay. So I'm hanging around with the last guy that I was with right before I got sober. Oh, yeah. He was a peach. And let me tell you. No, you don't want to know. My mom calls and says, my idiot husband wants, I'm not taking him to Maui. He's being a jerk. And thank God she left him finally. Took her how many years. But she said, I'm going to Maui. You coming? I'll be right there. So I feel like I'm special and unique because my last drunk was in Maui. It's in paradise, right? God. So we got there and we got to Costco and they had these all these flavored beers and everything. And, you know, by this time I'd really stepped away from the liquor because I could have really, it got out of control and it would get into, you know, just psychotic vomiting and sickness. And I hated that and it would freak me out. So I would try to just, you know, mix things and have more beer and wine. But I saw this fruit juice. It was the Mai Tai mix. And I was like, oh, yeah, hey, and there's some rum over there. Can we get my mom's like, can we get the beers? No, come on, we got this fruit juice. So I believe we drank a little bit that night. Of course we did. Next morning I got up and I poured myself a strong drink. And it's a little hazy after that. And I remember going and getting a second drink. And then I remember we were driving to Lahaina up the coast and vomiting out the side of the sports car, whatever it was we rented, Mustang. And then little bits of a blackout. My mom said that I tried to get into my undergarments and get in the pool in pretty much, you know, a blackout. Got back to the hotel, and that when I came to later that day, I should say, that bottle of rum was empty. And I don't think I poured it down the sink. And I'm so grateful that my mom was there to go hold up a mirror and say, this is what you've done. You drank that entire bottle of rum. And then you got violently sick, and then you're out of it. I mean, what's going on? I'm so grateful. Because, honestly, if we'd gotten that beer, it wouldn't have happened. It wouldn't have been so nasty. But can I just say that beer, you have to drink so much of it that you get the suds, and then you get fuzzy, and then you're throwing up. It's too much liquid to liquor ratio. No. So, like, yeah. So, but then I couldn't handle the liquor, so it's all a mess. Anyway, so I did drink a little bit, you know, on the rest of the trip, but I did not get wasted. So my last drunk was in late August of 2012, actually. So we got home, and I was talking with my mom, and she said, I don't know what exactly she'd said, but it was the idea of, you know, this is what your life is coming to. And I remember having this vision of me, oh, yeah, I have this vision of me being in a straitjacket with my pedal to the metal. And I have no control except that I'm going as fast as I can, but everybody around me is pissed off and cursing at me because I'm not driving my car right. So can we talk about powerlessness and unmanageability? my original sober date was September 13th of 2012, but I did not put down the benzos because those were prescriptions. Yeah. And the doctor gave those to me, and I needed those to sleep, right? So, and something that that Chuck said a while ago is that I was just padding my disease. I was just giving it just a little bit. So no, I wasn't really sober. And in the beginning, I went 3 weeks and didn't even white knuckle. I just walked away from everything. But I had the benzos to kind of calm the nerves, right? So my first meeting is I walked into Shade Tree, and Lolly was my sponsor for a time, and she fired me. But I'm kind of grateful that she did because it helped me to kind of get a wake-up call. And I remember sitting in here in late November of 2012. And I remember saying, I'm not doing the things that I ought to do because I don't love me. And I don't care about me enough to care to do it right. I could sit here and say I feel like I didn't get a lot of direction. Nobody really helped me to understand. But I didn't put forth the effort. And you know that when newcomers come in and they're on fire, man, we scoop them up. But if they're hanging out and they don't really know what to do, we don't chase after them, right? So that was me. I was hanging out on the edge, just kind of like, because my first... My first exposure to any kind of a program was Marijuana Anonymous when I was back in California and my daughter was little, and I called one of them up and they said, okay, well, you call 10 people a day and tell them you're not going to get stoned. And I'm going, wait, no. So I stayed away from y'all a long time because I didn't want you in my business. And even that first night that I went to the Hermitage group and, you know, and I got a desire chip and everybody just flooded me in, which we do, and I think it's wonderful, but at the time I'm like, oh my God, get away from me. You know, you're not going to like me if you get to know me. How many times have you heard somebody say that? You're not going to like me. So in the end of November, I was, you know, getting pretty sick, sad, and sorry, and dry drunk because I had no solution, and I really only had my benzos. And it was getting worse and worse. So of November the 29th, I guess, yes, got up and got my daughter on the school bus, and I don't remember this either, but I told her dad, well, I'm either going to die or I'm going to California. So that's a big split right there. So I did. I went back to the house. I should have gotten in my car and gone to work, but I made the conscious, went around the house and tried to figure out, okay, how I'm going to do this. And I saw myself putting a rope around my neck and jumping off the balcony, and I was too scared that the rope would break, or I'd break my ankles, or I was too chicken, you know what, to do it. So I went in the basement and wrapped a purse around my neck and kicked the chair out. I mean, the whole, like, you know, spectacle thing. Passed out, and I hit the floor. I think my ass hit first, thank God, and then my head. So I wake up, and I'm upstairs in my bedroom, and my ear's bleeding, but I'm cool, leave me, you know. And thank God, too, her dad, you know, he's in his own way, but he does care. And his girlfriend, who I've made amends to, and bless her heart, she's a good girl, but she said, you need to go see about Jamie. You need to go see about her. And he did, because he was like, screw her. You know, I'm so tired of her bullcrap, and he kept rescuing me and saving me and saving me, but he did. Called the ambulance and went to Summit, then went to Vanderbilt, and my mom said, I'll be right there. And she called, and oh, goodness. So I'm laying there in the bed, and I'm just sleeping, and I felt her put her hand in my hand, and I knew it was my mama. I knew it was her. Okay. So, nobody has a tissue? Come on now. Thank you. Oh, yeah. Well, they had to take me to the psych wards. This is my third suicide attempt. Oh, I forgot the second one, but no, I didn't. It was the overdose. So, so they had to put me in a psych ward, right? And I had worked, actually, at the one over here at Stewart's Ferry for almost 3 years. And I knew that if I went there, I would not be safe. Even if I was on a one-to-one observation, I wouldn't be safe because I'd made a lot of enemies, you know, and I'd stole a lot of girls. I stole their men and, you know, did, you know, smoke dope and would, you know, do other assorted things in the medicine room and, yeah, chemicals and things. So, no, I didn't want to be there. So they took me to Chattanooga. And right away they stopped giving me that good narcotic, you know, the opiates. Yeah, so ouch. I was not a very nice person. I had a lady come attack me while I'm sitting in the psych ward, and I kicked her about 4 foot across the room, and this schizophrenic guy is coming over going, come here, meet me in the corner, take your clothes off. I mean, just, oh, wrong, man. I'm not even kidding you. So, like, thinking that's going to do it, right? Yeah, I'll be right over there. Oh. So, So I remember I was on, like, a Dilaudid drip, okay, at Vandy, and then they're giving me Lortab 5 at the psych ward. Like, really? Like, that's Skittles. Like, what are you doing? So I remember this sweet nurse. She was an angel, I swear. She said, would you like some ibuprofen? Oh, God, yes, please, because I knew somehow that would help. So that night I laid in my bed next to my schizophrenic neighbor, not the guy, but a girl this time, thank God. And this was, you want to talk about spiritual warfare and spiritual experience. This is the first encounter that I had. Now, I'd already established a higher power long ago. You know, I turned away from the church and subscribed to my higher power, which is the goddess and nature and trees and all that tree hugging stuff. So, but I know that night that I was freed from some evil things that were living in me. You know, all this ugly stuff and ugly things I'd done, and something had held on to me. And I prayed and prayed to the aspects of my higher power that I knew could tear that stuff out. And Stephanie's making me cry. I just imagined that my chest was filleted open, and there were things that left. Now, was I coming down off the narcotics? Yes. But I truly believe that I was freed that night. And I woke up that next day, and it was December 8th, 2012, and that is my sobriety date. I changed my sobriety date to that day because I knew that was the day that I said, okay, God, I don't know what's going on, but I can't do this by myself, and I need your help. So I had to be in a neck brace with a broken skull. Still can't smell, still can't taste really well, but that's okay. I'm alive. But I had to be broken and bleeding and just a wreck before I was ready to say, oh, God, I need your help. Some of us, it doesn't take that level, but it did for me, and I'm grateful. Whew. So my mom flew me home to her home, in San Jose, which is where we're going in a couple weeks, and I was on fire. I wanted that AA so bad, and I knew that's where I needed to be. You know, I had known when I'd been sober for about 3 weeks, and my mind started spinning. I said, well, I think these people know how to help me. I'm going to go see what they're up to. So started going to meetings there, and women would come pick me up and be of service. So here I am, you know, a couple days sober off of 100% everything, right? And I had a great lady named Marina, who I'm still in touch with, and I get to see her, and I'm so excited. She helped me to really understand that I was an alcoholic, because I thought, here I'm in a neck brace with a broken skull, okay? I'm not an alcoholic. I don't drink like these people that drink every single day, and they're sloppy and sloshy. Like, no, that's nasty. No, right? Because you're looking down on the world. But she said, so what happens when you drink? And I went, oh, God. All right. So that means I'm an alcoholic? Yes. All right. Because I did, and my mom would, oh, God, my mom, when Sophia was a baby, she was staying with us, and she said, you know, there's a day that I came over, and it was 5 in the afternoon, and your daughter, Rihanna, was sitting on the floor, and she was probably about 2. And my boyfriend and I were passed out probably because we'd been up the whole night before doing what you do all night, and it just broke my heart. But I said, thank you, Mom, because I need to hear those things. I need to remember what I've done and where I've been. Got my 30 days there in San Jose, and I came back, and I came right back to this meeting, and I picked up another 30-day chip, and I think it was John. He said, where have you been, and what's been happening? And so I got to tell it, and whew, I've always cared about this group. Chuck really likes this group, and I let him have his own meetings, so I let him come here, but this has always been home. That's not, I didn't think that was funny. No, really, because he needs to have his, and I have mine, so... So I stayed in a halfway house for about 4 months, and they'd said, you have to go to one women's meeting a week. And I was like, well, okay, I remember the Shade Tree. They got that women's thing going on over there. And so I went over there, and I just dug in my roots over there, and I helped Annie to run that meeting and make coffee and choose speakers and chair and all that. So that is my quote-unquote home group. That's where I do my service. Yes. Oh, and I want to talk really quickly about the women in the program. You know, we come in, we don't want to be around the women. We don't want to be around other girls, you know, because you're in competition for what I want. Because we know how to get what we want out of the men. It's pretty easy, you know, because we got stock and trade. We can work that stuff out. So, but the girls, you know, we're in competition, you know. And you're a bitch, and I don't like you, and quit looking at me, and, you know, you dress better than I do, and, you know, it's all this, bleh. But I'm telling you now, like, I've been to 2 women's retreats up in Franklin, Kentucky, and just gotten to know some of the ladies here, and I tell you, if it weren't for the women in this program, I wouldn't be here. That is an integral part of my fellowship. So grateful. Doris knows this, but when she sponsored me, she was the one that helped me to understand step one. And helped me to realize, I got the whole thing about the powerlessness, because, you know, I'd put stuff in my body, and then I'd turn into a psycho, and, you know, Mr. Hyde, so, no. But she literally said to me outside, she goes, you think you've been sober now for a while, so life's pretty manageable, huh? And I was like, yeah. And then she helped me to understand that I can jack it up in here in about, you know, a quarter of a second. And I was like, ah, oh, dang it. All right, fine. So unmanageable. So when I think when I finally kind of grasped that, it was easy to then, you know, move forward. Lori and I were doing some step two a couple weeks ago, and I like the story at the end of that book where the preacher's son was talking about going from obsession to revulsion. And to me, that is my self-returning to sanity, because I think about drinking or drugs now, and literally if I think about alcohol too long, then I get sick, and I literally want to puke. And then I might, okay, how about this? About a month or so ago, I was going to see this man that lived up off White Bridge, and where apparently there's a lot of dope and all that. That man I said, "Where's your medicine for blood pressure?" And he digs it out of the couch and hands it to me, and it's an 8-ball of Coke in my hand. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I literally, my thought was, well, let me just taste that, and then I'll know what it is. Yeah. And then I went, no. But I think about the drugs now, and I think it's never enough. So don't even freaking start. It's just not worth it. Leave it alone. You got a much better life now. I met Chuck at Woodbine, and he knew that I had that, I was on fire, that he knew that I would do whatever it took to get sober. And we made us a baby shortly after that. And so I've got 2 years and some change now. Well, I just kicked on through that. Goodness. Well, I mean, let's see. I say my step three and my step six prayer, or seven prayers, every morning. I tell my higher power, "I love you and I love myself, and without you I'm nothing, and I will die. But I'd really like to stay here, and let me help another alcoholic today." I am not having to fight. It took me, I think, almost a year before I quit fighting the process, and I quit trying to fight all the change, and I still am a control freak, but who isn't? And so, what was it? Was it Monday or Tuesday, babe, my job? It might have been Tuesday. Yeah, I got called to the administrator's office, and they said, "Yeah, you need to leave." Okay. But I tell you what, God gave me the ability to handle that with grace and dignity. And I said, okay. Because I really was tired of that job, and it was time to move. But you know why I lost that job? Because I was trying to control things, and I was trying to act above what I should be doing. So just because I'm sober doesn't mean I'm well, and doesn't mean that I'm doing right. But I honestly think it was too much. But I did. I walked out of there with a smile on my face, and I didn't fear. I said, "God, you've got me." And I got to remember, God, you saved my butt. So I think you can handle the job thing. How are we doing? Let's see. Oh, being a sponsor, I've had a couple different sponsees. Just have the one now, and I love her dearly, dearly, dearly. And to be able to have somebody that never really understood step one and has gone through their own bouts back and forth, but to watch somebody really understand step one and realize that this, you don't have to go back. You don't have to go back to where you were. And that it's okay to hold on to the present and move forward. It's a beautiful thing. Still working on my steps because I'm a slow goer, but getting there. Grateful for my sponsor, Connie. She's amazing, and she's really helped me to trust God. And I get so pissed off and riled up, and she'll go, "Well, God's everything, or he's nothing." Oh, dang it, don't I get to be something? Oh, man. So, and I say, all right. But like with this job thing, I just knew it's going to work out. And I did have something else that was there, and they were very happy to have me back. It's amazing that I can be so spun and so freaked out about something, but then someone else comes to me and asks me for a good word or for a shoulder to cry on, and God gives me the words and the comfort to give that person. And, you know, my family, my very best cousin I was closest to, she said that if this whole sobriety thing didn't stick after that last suicide attempt and the whole hitting rock bottom, if that didn't stick, then she was probably going to give up. But she didn't. And I've got my family back. I don't have a big family, but I've got them back. I forgot to tell about my crazy dad. When I was 4 months sober last year, he said, "Screw you, you're dead to me, get out of my life." And a lot of times we'll see that in our families. They're still sick, and they don't want to be around your beautiful shining light and glory of God, so you just go over there and get out of my life. Have not seen him since April of 2013. Chuck just asked me to call him on Christmas Eve day, and I did, and he answered the phone. I said, "Dad, it's Jamie. Merry Christmas." He said, "Okay, thanks. Bye." That's all I got left. And I know that I may not even hear when he passes. I may not even get to go to his funeral. All of the things that should have been mine aren't mine. And yes, I was an idiot, and I did do some hurtful things to him. But was really it all just to say, forget it, you're not in my life anymore? I don't know. I pray for him. So let's see what else. Beautiful thing is I'm so, so very grateful that I was able to raise my daughter, Rihanna, that I was able to get sober when she was 11. Because if I'd have waited until she was 15 or 16, boy, the damage I would have done and the place she would have been in her mind. All the daughters that are in my life, you know, all of their parents are both one of us. They're all deep in it. Some of them sober, some of them not. So I've tried to work on getting her to Alateen, and she's going a little. I don't get it, Mom. What are they doing? Trust me, just keep going. But I want her to know that no matter what, if she ever needs us, we're here, and not be afraid. And there was a day when she said, well, I don't really like who you are, because she couldn't manipulate me anymore, right? It wasn't just party, party, Mom. But she goes, but I don't want you to go back to the way you were. That was beautiful. And she is. She's doing better and helping take care of her baby girl sister. And our home life is actually a beautiful thing. I mean, we might squabble or fuss at each other, but we don't fight. Honestly, we don't fight. There's not chaos. There's not drama. There's not anger and jealousy and ugliness. There's happiness and joy and peace and lots of laughter. I mean, you might see him and think he's just a gruff, grumpy old man, but I swear to God, he's a teddy bear. Gosh, what else? I think that's good. Very grateful to the Yet Group. Thank you for Stacy for nominating me. I heard it was you. And Chuck was going to nominate me anyway, so. But you know, I want to be that one that says when the hand of AA reaches out, I want to be there to take it up. And they said, well, they want me to speak. And I said, all right. I don't want to, but okay, fine. I choose this life. I'm extremely grateful for this life. I don't ever want to go back to the way I was. There's no point. The chaos, the psychotic anger and suicide and fear and hate and a lot of vomiting. Yeah. No thanks. God. So I think I'll stick around. And like I said at the 805 group, my name's Jamie and I have no reservations.
Thanks, Jamie, and who keeps us sober?
Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory. Forever and ever. Amen.
Keep coming back. It works if you work it.